Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls for this morning. Well, in this part of the show, we'll be talking a little bit about economics, particularly about how modern economists wrestled with and perhaps resolved one of the oldest puzzles in the field of economics, something that goes really back to the foundation of modern economic thinking with Adam Smith. And it has to do with the fact that there are two ideas that seem to be in conflict with one another. On the one hand, economists have always argued that as businesses grow, so does productivity. Say you have a manufacturing concern. If you can have a number of employees doing different steps in the process, then each of them can be more productive, then your enterprise overall can be more productive, and you can make more profit. Economists also believe that free markets thrive on competition. And here, there is the essence of the conflict, because this idea that as businesses grow bigger, they're more productive, their cost of production goes down, their profits go up, that kind of tends to favor the growth of monopolies, and that works against the idea that there always has to be competition. Well, this morning we'll be talking particularly about how one economist managed to work out this conflict in the way of and did that by thinking of goods in a different way than they had been thought of before, making this distinction between things that are actually physical that somebody could own and ideas, which are things that truly nobody can own. Our guest for the program is David Warsh. He is a former columnist for the Boston Globe. He now writes the online newsletter Economic Principles, and he's the author of a book that is titled Knowledge and the Wealth of Nations, A Story of Economic Discovery. It's published by W.W. Norton and is recently out. As we talk, questions are welcome. As always, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep our program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But of course, people are welcome to join the conversation. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. At any point here, people can join us. Mr. Warsh, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Nice of you to have me on.
Well, I have to admit that this is one of those things, you know, economics, there are two subjects that I continue to try and do programs on and always feel that I'm not really making any progress in understanding them. One has to do with the origins of the universe. The other one, economics. So, so I have to tell you that I feel that my grasp here on the subject matter is pretty tenuous.
Well, it's good of you to keep trying. I think, I mean, the economists themselves keep trying, and their grasp gets less tenuous, I think, as time goes by. But they're a funny community. They like to think of themselves as sort of resembling physicists sometimes. I'm not sure that's the self understanding that will ultimately emerge. But you know, it's interesting the way you set this thing up. It is the way the book comes out, but I took pains in the book to describe economics as a community, a large community of people working together over a long period of time, over a couple hundred years, really, since Adam Smith sort of laid down the groundwork for the field, what we call these days a paradigm in the Wealth of Nations. So the first chapters in the book really sort of describe economists going about their business at their annual meetings of the American Economic Association, and the kind of little communities that have developed over these 200 years to specialize in, you know, labor economics and medical economics and microeconomics and macroeconomics, and only deep into the book, into the second chapter, does the character about whom the with whom the book is concerned, as he emerges, a guy named Paul Romer, who's an interesting guy. I'll tell you about him in a minute. But anyway, the point is that nothing gets done by one person really in economics. It's this large community of people over time, long dead white males and present day people of all sorts who are trying to figure out how this thing works.
Well, you know, the forgive me for bringing up the old joke about, you know, you get 10 economists in a room and ask them an important question, you get 15 answers.
Yeah.
That I think that the perception that people often have of the field is that that there's a disconnect between the kind of the theoretical world in which economists work when they try to explain the way the economy actually does work, and sort of a disconnect between their realm and the actual and the real world.
Yep, widely remarked. It's been diminishing, I think. I'll give you what I think is a pretty good example. The business of hedging against uncertainty is something that practical people have been up against in the world for centuries, and practices of hedging, buying and selling futures contracts emerged in Holland in the 17th century and were transmitted by practical people, you know, mostly father to son for a long time, from field to field, and eventually got into the grain pits in the Midwest in the late 18th and 19th century, places where traders, not economists, but traders, became very good at selling, you know, August wheat if there was rain, August wheat if there wasn't rain. So the grain pits in Chicago became, you know, really important institutions by the turn of the century, sufficient to attract the attention of novelists and stuff. 50 or 60 years passed before economists began to really wonder what it was that these practical guys were doing. In Chicago, it was the butter and egg exchange that was the most adept at writing futures contracts. And in the 50s, I would say, and in the 1950s and 1960s, economists mainly in Chicago and Cambridge began studying what was it about options contracts and warrants that were really, what was the essence of the things. They published a lot about in technical journals. Meanwhile, the practical people were continuing to sort of design new contracts that could be traded and stuff. And the whole thing came together in the late 60s in the literature about options pricing, optimal options pricing, which gave rise to this thing called the Black-Scholes options pricing formula that could be programmed into what was a brand new thing at the time, a little handheld chip-based computer, a calculator, and in two or three years at the beginning of the 70s, the old butter and egg exchange exploded into the Chicago Mercantile Exchange as sort of engineering knowledge that economists had come up with raced ahead. Is that the right word? I don't know. Began to surpass the practical knowledge that these old grain pit and other kinds of futures traders had amassed over the centuries. And in a very short period of time, those markets, which we now talk about as being markets for risk, markets where futures and options contracts are exchanged, they became trillion-dollar markets with people participating from them all over the world. That was a case where I would say that knowledge derived from economics ran ahead of knowledge that had been accumulated over the years by practical people who were essentially sort of Edisonian tinkerers. Hmm. And in the book, I make a big song and dance, a chapter about how exactly this process took place in physics in the 19th century, and how the early adventures in electricity, starting with Benjamin Franklin, gave way all of a sudden in a period of 10 years to James Clerk Maxwell, who formalized and who began actually with a physical model of how he thought electromagnetism worked. Wound up at a certain point throwing away the physical model, which was just really an oak board, and writing it down in mathematics and creating an understanding of the physics of the electromagnetic spectrum that became the basis for radio, for television, for quantum physics, for all kinds of other things. It's a fairly familiar process, I think, in physics. It begins in a practical understanding. It gives way to a kind of a technology that people understand well enough to manipulate, and then it moves into a genuinely deep scientific understanding. Long answer.
Well, let me raise this. So here, this is obviously a big question, but I think that again, that if you talk about what are the forces that drive the economy, what kind of predictions can we make I think that people, again, have this idea that, well, you know, there are economic cycles. It goes up, it goes down. There's boom, there's bust. That nobody really knows why. So that makes it very difficult for anybody to say, next year the economy is going to do this, 5 years it's going to do this, 10 years it's going to do this. Is that, in fact, a misunderstanding? Do we now have a better idea about what it is that drives cycles and ups and downs in the economy good enough so that we can actually make some predictions about the future?
Well, not good enough that we can make precise predictions, for sure. A lot of what the shouting has been about these last 50 or 60 years has had less to do with predicting it than it has had to do with managing it, with understanding what we can do with central banking and what we can't do, with understanding what happens when you get into a great big macroeconomic event like the Depression and what you might reasonably do to get out of it. Now, people still argue a lot about what portion of the cure of the Depression was simply the Second World War, which had governments all over the world jetting up their economies to the max, and what portion was derived from sort of a Keynesian understanding of the dynamics of the situation. I think probably most economists today would recognize it was more the former than the latter, but the fact remains that economists got very excited in the 30s about a series, I think it's not a mistake to call them discoveries about how the world economy fit together, what could go wrong with it, and not in time to save the world from depression, but in time to understand much better after the Second World War how to manage the economy, how to run a central bank, how to think of unemployment, how to think of fiscal policy, the stimulative effect of government spending. I think as a result, we came out of the Second World War with a world economy that, gave us immediately, it gave us 50 years of the greatest boom in history. There were recessions, we used to call them crashes or panics or busts. The new terminology was recessions, but we understood much better government's opportunity to sort of manage this thing in such a way that we wouldn't have another depression. Then it turned out that there's another phone ringing here, and I'm going to turn it off. Then it turned out that there was a side effect of this management that we call inflation that became very, very serious in the 70s and led to a couple of pretty nearly panics at the beginning of the 80s. And I think the economic community has spent a lot of time understanding how that came about and how it might be prevented. And the result is that we've had now 15 years of very low inflation. So I think those two crude examples are pretty good examples of how, macroeconomists have learned how to manage this thing.
So
it's not the same as being able to tell you how much it's going to grow next year, but it's progress.
Yeah. Well, so if then, for example, I'm president of the United States and you're the chairman of my Council of Economic Advisors, if I say to you, look, I don't really need to know how this works. All I want is I want to maintain high productivity, high employment, and low inflation. Can you tell me how to do that?
Yeah, I think the guys today can do that. There's a lot of disagreement still about whether that means keep taxes so low that you run a big deficit over a long period of time or manage the economy in such a way that you come close to surplus in the prosperous time so that you can spend it down and have it run a deficit in times of recession. But I think the moral is that the guys in international economics pretty much know what they're doing. They have a big argument at the moment about the global imbalances in trade and whether they absolutely portend a hard landing at some point in the future or whether this thing is sustainable. This thing being the extent to which we buy from China and sell them Treasury bills. We live off the savings of other countries, we in the United States. Economists are reasonably divided about that, and I think that it's unlikely that we're going to see an age of real scientific precision in those things set in anytime soon. But that economists should have narrowed their disagreements to that point, I think that's encouraging.
We have a caller here that we need to get to in a moment, but I also think that we have some weather information that we want to pass on to you. And I think Scott Althoff is in the weather office, and he has a warning for us. Scott, what do you got?
Yeah, the National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for southeastern Vermilion County and east central Illinois until noon central time at 11:17. The National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated a severe thunderstorm capable of producing of nickel-sized hail and damaging winds of excess of 60 miles per hour. The storm is located near Georgetown or about 13 miles south of Danville and is moving east at 20 miles per hour. Locations impacted include Danville and Georgetown and rural locations in Vermilion County. Other locations the warning include Ridge Farm, Tilton, and Westville. This is a dangerous storm. If you're in this path, prepare immediately for damaging winds and destructive hail and deadly cloud-to-ground lightning. So, repeating, that's a severe thunderstorm warning for southeastern Vermilion until noon central time.
All right. Thank you very much, Scott. And we do want people to keep in mind that there is this possibility for severe weather in our listening area, certainly in our severe weather coverage area. There's a severe thunderstorm watch that is in effect for parts of central and northern Illinois and all of the northern half of Indiana that will be in effect until 2 o'clock central time. There is a possibility there that we'll be interrupting our program once again. If we do get more warnings, we will certainly bring them to you. Let's talk now with a caller. We have someone on the cell phone in calling from over near Mahomet, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to ask you a question, which I think you could answer in about a five-hour time period. And this is the following. What do you think that economics might have a future in the prediction of the behavior of institutions and organizations, and do you think it has a future in the behavior of individuals? And to be specific, what do you think about the use of agent-based modeling and computer simulation? There's big articles on that in Nature in the last 3 weeks.
Hmm.
What do you think of the study of neuroeconomics and behavioral economics, which are all basically take an atomistic, if you want, viewpoint where you start with the individual and you try to get a model of both individual and collective behavior. There seems to be a growing feeling. First, the economists reject the physicists completely, a lot of them, and also the physicists are starting to say, you know, Maxwell really wasn't modeling an individual atom, and he was modeling collectives. And the proper modeling tool is not the individual, but is in fact a bigger organizational unit, and that there is some future in that for the physicists to play a role. So that's about a five or six, actually it's probably a multi-semester answer that would be required, but I'm interested in your opinions on that. Thank you.
Well, it's a terrific question. There's a lot of excitement over a very broad front in economics these days about questions that might be answered with the new tools that are available to economists and people in nearby fields. The most obvious of the new tools, obviously, is the computer. They have at their disposal now power that is to all scientists, but economists too, power that they couldn't even imagine. I mean, these are guys who the senior most generation are people who used to run their regressions with electromechanical calculators. Now suddenly they've got, you know, just jillions and jillions and jillions of bits that they can do simulations with. So there's a lot of people who think that, you know, not a lot of people, there are communities of people who think that numerical simulation is going to bring a degree of precision that has been missing before. Another tool that's very exciting to people is are the whole array of brain imaging instruments, like of which the PET scanner is the most obvious, that let them see what's going on in a person's brain as they respond to contrived economic stimuli in a or linguistic stimuli in a laboratory setting. That's neuroeconomics. Physioeconomics, which I think is behind your question, is a whole other case where new possibilities exist that weren't even really glimpsed 20 or 30 years ago. And now let me tell you what I really think about these possibilities. They're absolutely real. very bright people are working on them in communities all over the world that are in touch with one another. But the tendency here is going to be very similar to the tendency that was so pronounced in computer science in, say, the 50s and the 60s, when people got very excited about the possibilities for artificial intelligence. And deep differences of opinion, whatever the past tense of riven, divided the community in those years, about how quick we'd get to things like voice recognition or machine translation or chess-playing computers. And there was a kind of a bipolar syndrome that set in, a kind of manic depression that set in computer science and related fields for a good 25 or 30 years, where for 5 years, the scientists themselves would proclaim to journalists such as myself, you know, we're right on the verge of solving the deepest problems in this field, and within 7 years we'll have a chess-playing robot that can beat anybody, anytime. And then for the next 5 years, the pessimistic community would get the upper hand and say, you know, not only is this thing not in the offing, but it's probably impossible. The human mechanism is so complex that we'll never successfully model it with a computer in a way that is philosophically meaningful, even much less economically meaningful. Well, there again, you can observe the process as a kind of a zigzag towards machines that may not quite think today, but they can do a pretty damn good job of thinking, and yet still very far short of the most dramatic imagining that people did back in the 50s and 60s. I think in all of these fields in economics, of which probably the most exciting thing across a broad front is what the economists now themselves call political economy. It's a new and pretty efficacious, I would say, interest in political institutions as they affect vital matters like economic growth. There, the interest is very deep in, you know, why constitutions seem to permit, successful constitutions seem to permit countries that have them to grow much faster than countries that don't have them. Countries, the economics of legislative assemblies are very interesting to people. There, I think we're making, you know, progress that will be substantial over 30 or 40 years, and that attracts the brightest people going into the field these days, that people speak about as the future economics. I think that the political economy is the nearer future than physioeconomics or neuroeconomics or behavioral economics is another one, where there are people who claim to have deep insights into anomalies that occur regularly in markets that may or may not be within reach to act upon. But it's an area where hype is easy to come by. I think that's my answer. The excitement's general, but the hype is real too.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone in Champaign. This line two. Hello.
Thank you. Yeah. I've yet to hear you talk about what I consider the elephant in the room, yet, which is the influence of power in economics and economies. And specifically, I guess I would say, you know, the ability of economic elites who have interests that, you know, don't necessarily coincide with the majority of people, you know, whether the majority in a given country or even, you know, the majority of the world, and their ability to put people in positions in the government and every place else, institutions, wherever they have to have them, in order to make, you know, things go, decisions be made in a way that serves their economic interests, which have both macro and macro and micro, effects. And, you know, it may not be good for a healthy economy, but sure makes them a lot more wealthy. And I haven't heard, you know, how you factor that into your, you know.
Yeah, well, I think you're right, and I think it's a topic of great interest to a lot of young economists these days. And you know, it's of interest to journalists and politicians and well informed citizens and anybody who has to live in the world. In economics, people now do a lot of work about. The difference between democracy and oligarchy, and the long range consequences for growth. I don't think there's, you know, among technical economists, I don't think there's any more consensus today than existed probably 15 or 25 or 50 years ago, for that matter. You know, that democracy is better than dictatorship for most purposes. That tightly controlled government programs like Singapore or Japan in the late 19th, early 20th century sometimes can produce very good results in growth, or the Soviet Union for that matter. They can through central planning, they can pull off big pushes in the jargon, big coordinated investment programs that result in a lot of economic growth fast, that nevertheless begins to peter out because it isn't sufficiently decentralized. So, you know, if there were something magic about oligarchies that seemed like a sustainable advantage, more people would be more interested in them. But even in a situation like Chile, where a bunch of dictatorial political people took over and employed the services of some much more liberal and sort of decent, well-intentioned University of Chicago economists in the 70s, even when you just kind of insist on doing it your way, the advantage seems to peter out after 15 or 20 years. So I think as economists sift the evidence, and political scientists and others sift the evidence is beginning to be pretty powerful that democracy and the decentralization of power not only is more just to live on, but it's more economically efficient.
Well, that still begs my question. The people, the economic elites, don't necessarily care about having an efficient economy. They care about building their wealth and mm-hmm. keeping their power. And they might be just as happy to live in, you know, an economy that is not necessarily efficient for everybody, but it's very good for them.
You're right, but that's why the political system is so important. You want a political system that lets people vote and lets them short circuit the self-interested, the narrowly self-interested actions of the economic elites. You know, I'm not aware of a country in the world that does that perfectly, but this one strikes me as doing a better job than most.
And so you don't have concern about the kind of shaky electoral system that we have at this point in time. Considering, I mean, I'm not alone in the belief that the election in 2000 was stolen, and I'd say there's an awful lot of evidence that the election was stolen in 2004, and nobody in the broad media really wants to look at the evidence. They just sort of sweep it under the rug, and I think that the same thing is going to happen in 2008 if we don't turn things around. So I guess I'm not so sanguine about the notion that we actually still have a functioning democracy in this country.
That's my worry. That's fair enough. I'm in the more sanguine camp, but I'm sure not dismissive of your concerns. I just I'm inclined to think it still works pretty well, and I'm inclined to look for a very different result in the next presidential election. So it's I used to do this a lot when I wrote for newspapers, but now I more narrowly cover technical economics and stick to that. But I understand what you mean. I just hope it's not so.
Yeah. And I hope the caller will forgive me for jumping in here. We're already past our midpoint. I have another I want to get, and also to introduce again the guest for anybody who might have just tuned in. We're talking with David Warsh. He's a former columnist for the Boston Globe. He now writes the online newsletter Economic Principles and is author of a new book that looks at how it is over time the field of economics changed, developed. The title of the book is Knowledge and the Wealth of Nations, A Story of Economic Discoveries. The subtitle is published by W.W. Norton, and it's just recently out, so you certainly can find it in the bookstore. And questions are welcome here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go next and talk with someone in Charleston, and that's our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Two words that have been used so far, one by yourself, the word paradigm, and one that has not been used, I don't think, or at least when I'm between the radio and the phone, is the imperialization, the effects of imperialization upon the activities of humans. I mean, it occurs. You know, with the being a Marxist, I think I understood what the old man meant by money accruing into the hands of fewer and fewer people. Therefore, the other that paradigm being what it is, then the power accrues to fewer and fewer hands. And the democratic idea is bully fine, but it is not practiced. And in my research, I've never found any incident of democracy where society was ruled by people. Hence the Republican aspect of it, which, you know, now is fraught with what I think some local, international pundits are calling the rule of a vehement majority, which you know is what exists now. We have a 51% majority of Republicans, and the nation is evenly split, and there's absolutely nothing anybody can do. And here we are, couched on top of the world, manipulating everything that happens worldwide, and then in the interest of a few. And there again, the imperialized nature of capital, which Marx pointed out very succinctly, is what we, and Lenin as well, that now we are living. That is the paradigm by which is far decayed, I think, because look at the dichotomy or the distance between the haves and the have-nots. I'm sorry if I went on, but if you'll answer, I'll kind of hang on here.
Yeah, well, let me try. This story I tell in the book treats this, but it treats it in a slightly different way. I'm going to just speak to your question. I think that, you know, the evidence is that the gap between the haves and the have-nots probably is narrowing substantially. It's hard to tell because the rich sure as the dickens get richer, and the peaks of wealth with economic growth, with the growth of knowledge, it become, you know, just incredibly high. All the while, this other process has been going on that's been sort of spreading wealth much more evenly over the, or much more widely over the surface of the earth. If you take just a simple indicator like lifespan, longevity, human longevity has increased so dramatically, not just here, but in China and India as well. You have to leave Africa out because of AIDS. It skews everything. But people live longer, they're healthier, and measured by money income, they're much wealthier than they were 50 years ago, or much, much wealthier than they were 100 years ago. So to my mind, that's evidence that the sort of the broad economic, you know, classical economic scheme associated with Adam Smith was a better prediction of how things would work out than Marx. Marx brought an awful lot to the discussion, and much more than he gets credit for. But I think the general economic view of the world is that there's going to be this sort of gradual convergence among countries, similar to what happened between the Japanese and the Americans. In the years after World War II, Japan was a very, very poor country 50 years ago. And today, it's on a par with the United States. So, I guess I don't think I'm going to persuade you that Marx was wrong in some sense, but I urge you to read the book, and you'll see in certain senses how Smith was right, and how the people against whom Marx railed were deeply wrong. Marx was, you know, in the middle of the 19th century, Marx was the only guy around who had a clue, you know, what was going on. And what happened was that he posed such a threat that the economists had to dig deep and come up with John Stuart Mill in the first instance to sort of counter the argument. Mill being a classical liberal, that Marx stuff was pretty powerful at the time.
Well, my only further comment would be the evidence speaks for itself. Mm-hmm. If we in the U.S., you know, the most highly developed, so to speak, or as the word goes, which I'm at odds with that, but when people have money in their pocket, and you must have money in order to live, the only act of the human do without money is to breathe air, which is a man I heard on the program some time ago who said that money was right up there with air. Well, that young man was succinctly right, because if you don't have money, you do not have anything. You have absolutely no social services, no means of getting there, and there is absolutely no way except the capitalist paradigm that provides supposed work. I mean, now with all, and another one of your statements was higher productivity. Well, higher productivity means that fewer people doing more work for less money when there's a huge mass out there that has absolutely no access. And then you get out of the U.S. and then it just becomes more horrendous. And as you said, AIDS is not the only thing that attacked Africa. I mean, there was the British and a whole bunch of others who went and exploited that place, you know, into near oblivion. But unless we figure out how to feed the world and we learn how to take care of the social needs of the world, and I don't think capitalism can produce or can last long enough. You know, the feudalists, the church, the monarchs thought they had it all by the tail. There was absolutely no way that they were ever going to be deposed, that their power was going to be sacrificed or lost somehow. But when they could not do the very things that humans demand every day, is food, water, shelter, and some sort of doctoring, even was by a medicine man, I mean, which was available in subsistence cultures. But if we do not provide those services, then the system has failed. I don't give a damn how technologically good it becomes. Unless you can get some meat on the table or some vegetables down the throat, you are going to die. And that is what is happening on this earth today. 50 million people in this country have no health insurance and no access to a doctor. Those who do then go into debt for medical services, end up in court. You know, the judge, the court system, in bed with the hospitals in order to collect the money that was owed under emergency conditions. I mean, I cannot think of anything that is being done right or that is futuristic in any way. I'm sorry again, I shouldn't go on, but I am so upset by these things that and when you see it in the news every day and the horrors that are visited upon humans around this world, both egregiously and stealthily, then it cries for something to be done. And I don't think technology or semantics of economics is somehow going to put food on the table. Well, I'll ring off, and thanks again, Dave.
Good of you to call.
We have about 15 minutes, maybe more like 10 or 12 minutes left in the Spartan Focus 580, talking with David Warsh. He's former columnist with Boston Globe. He now writes the online newsletter Economic Principles and author of the book Knowledge and the Wealth of Nations, and takes a little bit of a look at the history of modern economics, starting with Adam Smith and coming up to the present. Questions welcome. I also just like to remind you real quick that there is a severe thunderstorm warning in effect for southeastern Vermilion County and will be in effect for about another 15 minutes, so that's until noon central time. On the radar, it looks like there are still some pretty big storms in southern Vermilion County. So if you're in that area or in the path of the storm, you want to keep that in mind. And we do have the possibility for severe weather in our area at least until the middle of the afternoon. So we'll have all the information on the weather for you as it continues to develop. And coming up at 12:35 on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll give you the latest. I do want to have you talk a little bit about this problem that I mentioned at the beginning of the show that you do write about in the book. And that has to do with the issue of returns to scale and the invisible hand. And basically, I guess, as I understand it, there is in economics always was this idea that that somehow the market would always find the way for there to be competition, so that would tend to limit the possibility of any one company or a couple of companies to completely dominate a field and crush their competitors. That alongside that goes, though, this idea that says that as you get bigger, if you can hire more employees, you can break down the manufacturing process, you can make it specialized, each one can get more productive. So that means overall you're more productive, and that so
You can invest in R&D, you can invent new products, you can keep ahead of the competition.
And it seems that the idea, problem is, here's the two things, these two ideas, that there is some limit to returns to scale, and that there is always going to be natural competition. seem to run smack into each other. And so then we get to ultimately become to someone says, well, you know, if there's always going to be competition and returns to scale eventually start to diminish, then how do you explain Microsoft?
Yeah, well, exactly. Let me just answer that by telling you very briefly the story of the book in order to get up to Microsoft. The book says, you know, that Adam Smith, who wrote good plain English and who was as sensible a guy as you ever could hope to meet in the 18th century, wrote Knowledge and the Wealth of Nations and sort of created this vision that you've just described of a world in which competition was the consumer's friend, that companies would buy with one another to cut, you know, to bring the best thing to market for the lowest price, and that because of the competition of the invisible hand, there would be steady equilibrium growth in the world. The world would get richer, and people would become better off, and there'd be no concentration of power. And the real big problem was to keep your eye on government, because government was where they were people proclaiming their good intentions tended to work against the best interest of the consumer, either by raising taxes to pay for government programs or doing sweetheart deals with foreign powers to keep cheap Japanese automobiles out of the country, that sort of thing. Smith's vision was absolutely persuasive to people for 35 or 40 years, until two guys came along about 1800, each of whom had a reason why he thought Smith was wrong. One was T.R. Malthus, the other one was David Ricardo. They both said, yeah, it's very nice to be so cheerful, but the fact is, because the quantity of things in the world, the amount of real estate, is so limited, and the propensity of people to increase the population is so great, that it's not going to work out the way Smith imagined at all. We're going to overbreed into a population crisis, and people are going to die off. Or Ricardo, we're going to overbreed, and people who own land will become very rich, and everybody else will become very poor, and we'll wind up with a continual state of immiseration. Well, that set the stage for this big argument between Marx and Mill, and then subsequently the technical economists who replaced Mill, and they went on arguing more or less in that way, way up through Keynes, way up into the modern era. What happened at a certain point in the 80s, what the book is really about, is about how some economists, chiefly this guy named Romer, realized, many people realized, but how he really put his finger on what the problem had been with John Stuart Mill as economics took this thing on. They left the growth of knowledge out of the field altogether. They left it out because it was very hard to model mathematically or to be very precise about. So they simply said that's not what we do. It's clear that knowledge grows. It's clear that's where productivity comes from. I'm leaving aside incidentally this business about competition versus monopoly, but they just simply managed to sweep to bracket knowledge, to push it aside and say that's not our department. What happened in the 30s and 40s was people began to have this argument that you're talking about, David, about monopoly versus competition. They began noticing big corporations every place. They realized that markets were carved up between them, and guys, smart Midwestern guys, particularly a guy from Iowa named Chamberlain, came up with doctrines of monopolistic competition, in which companies were sort of half like monopolies and half competitive. And they argued among themselves endlessly about whether monopolies were going to have gain the upper hand or whether this competition would break through in the end. What happened when Romer came on the scene is that he realized he persuaded other people that knowledge was the essence of the monopoly involved, and that firms had different ways of maintaining their monopolies, but that since knowledge was, in his phrase, non-rival, since nobody could get a corner on knowledge except through a patent and a patent or a secret, and neither a patent nor a secret was especially stable or you couldn't hang on to it for very long, that the knowledge was always going to bust out and that there would always be competition among firms. And I think that's roughly what we've seen. The example you give, Microsoft, is a perfect example, because it's a situation where they had a lock on the market for computer operating systems, not through a patent, but through a standard, Everybody wanted a window system at a certain point, starting in the mid '80s, because it was what they'd been trained on. It was what they could take the knowledge of to the next company they worked for. It was what they knew to run on their own PC, and because Microsoft owned the Windows label, and because they protected the source code so that nobody could adapt it for their own purposes, Microsoft really seemed to be in the 90s, when the government went off after them on antitrust grounds, they seemed to be the perfect example of a company that could take over an entire global market. I mean, it was conceivable that every small computer, every computer, every server, every router would run on a Microsoft Windows product ultimately. The only thing like that, in our experience, you have to go back 100 years before, to the telephone system, which was engineered in a very similar way, with more regulation, more legislation involved. But it was a situation where the Bell companies were able to completely drive a technology forward for 100 years. Well, what happened to the Bell system is roughly what's happened to the Microsoft system in the last 10 years. People have invented around it, come up with substitutes that of which Linux is just one. Substitutes that begin to make inroads into Microsoft's ability to challenge to control the direction of the technology. Same thing with telephone. I mean, the Bell system lost control, you know, in ways that they couldn't have predicted. Lost control of the system in the late 60s, actually. And by the mid 80s, it was clear that the government should break them up and take them apart. So, in the end, competition does seem to rule, but this force of specialization is a very powerful force, and that's actually where the growth comes from. Specialization almost always reflects increasing knowledge.
So, if indeed we're moving into this time when knowledge is going to be even more important, and it's going to be an important good, then among the things that you argue is that then that makes the idea of patents and copyrights and the fact that we enforce those things even more critical. Because that's the only thing that's going to give you some reason to go ahead and develop your ideas if you're sure that you're actually going to be able to hold on to them at least for a little while.
But it's not the only thing. I mean, there are other ways to get people to innovate. And I think the idea that intellectual property is the only device to keep us moving forward, that's probably been oversold. I'll give you an example of a way to get people to invent that doesn't involve personalizing property that way. There was this big problem of needing a very dependable marine chronometer, a clock that could be used to tell longitude. In the late 18th century, ships were crashing into rocks all over the world, because they didn't know where they were. So the British government announced a contest for the first dependable, absolutely, and specified a set of tests that it would have to pass, the first dependable marine chronometer. This is a story told in a wonderful book called Longitude by a woman named Dava Sobold. It's everybody's good example of this these days. And after 20 years or 30 years, a guy came up with a design that met all the tests, and the government turned around and made that design available to anybody who wanted to build a marine chronometer. And the result was they only paid once for the invention. The guy got, you know, rich enough, but not endlessly rich. And mariners all over the world suddenly had a good way to navigate longitudinally as well as north south. That was easy. So the modern day counterpart of that, I think that is most frequently cited, is the malaria vaccine. The British government has specified exactly how a successful malaria vaccine would work, and they've said they'll pay a certain amount to the company that comes up with it, that meets with it, but then not royalties after that, not a patent on the medicine. Once they have it, they'll make it available to everybody, every place. And this is essentially the way we've done this through governments over the years. The polio vaccine was not nearly so much a patented thing as it was something that the government simply paid a guy to develop.
We are pretty much at the point here that we're going to have to stop, and my apologies, I have a couple of callers here I think I just don't have the time for. I guess as a way of finishing out, I find myself thinking about going back to what this means for policymakers and for people who are interested. And if what they're interested in is stimulating economic growth, then what do we do?
Support the University of Illinois system. for one thing. I mean, look how much growth has come out of the Illinois universities. All the hybridization of corn began up in DeKalb, basically, or got propagated. So much of the work on the transistor was done in Champaign-Urbana by Bardeen and a bunch of people in the very good chemistry department, physics department. The take-home message of the book is that you need to develop. Any country that wants to participate in the system needs to develop a good university system, needs to let people pass freely back and forth among countries, and it needs to educate the dickens out of its citizenry. It needs to produce lots and lots of scientists and engineers and relatively fewer MBAs and lawyers. Beyond that, I think just good economic housekeeping. Don't run huge deficits. Keep taxes low, but keep the budget in trim. That's all the stuff that flows out of this new work.
Pardon me, I've interrupted you there. I'm going to have to jump in, and because we're here at the point, we're going to have to stop. And what I can, however, say to people, if you're interested in reading more about the history of modern economics, you can take a look at the book that we've mentioned, Knowledge and the Wealth of Nations, published by Norton, W.W. Norton, by our guest David Warsh. He's a former columnist with Boston Globe. And Mr. Warsh, thanks very much.
It was good of you to have me, David. Thanks.